Welcome to All About Symbian, insight number 113, where we explain all the goings-on in the Symbian world over the past week, as well as offer you some news, some views, and some commentary on the wider mobile world. There's been a lot going on this week, which we'll be getting to in just a moment, but I'd like to introduce this week's co-host, who is the one and only...
Ewan Spence, hello! Yeah, where's Steve anyway? Is Steve still stuck in the How to Announce a Show Like a Radio 4 Today programme?
Steve is not going to be on this podcast, but no doubt he'll be joining us again next week. So I think we'll dive straight into the news item. We've got a few things to get through this week. And the first bit of news that was big this week was Nokia's move with Comes With Music in China. Now, Comes With Music has been around for a while. It's in about 13 countries, and it certainly had mixed reactions. But this Comes With Music was slightly different than what's come before, and I think Ewan can fill us in with more details.
Indeed, this is actually a really, really important political change. The Comes With Music files that will be shipped out in China, which is where this one is launched, will be in MP3 format. They will not have any of the DRM wrappings that restrict it to one computer or to one phone at a time, i.e. the system that's used in Windows Media to write protect files, that's not there. You download the file, it can go into any device, it can go around any computer, and it's just completely and utterly exactly like 99.95% of the rest of music downloads in China. Now, here's the key. Most of the Chinese music downloaded is pirated. They're breaking copyright, they're just downloaded like crazy, and it's all DRM free. And that meant that if you put Comes With Music in place with the DRM system, with what you have in Europe, it just would not work because there's a far easier way that's socially acceptable in China, which is just download it, just put it on the phone. Now, let's deal with all the complaints of the European people going, oh, but the grass is redder over in China, and deal with some more important points. The first thing is this. The music industry have agreed to this. Nokia, when it's music industry, said, this is not going to work unless we go DRM-free, unless we go to a file like MP3. And the music industry has went and agreed to it. Now, this is actually huge. They've agreed to it in small parts in the occasional countries out here in Europe. So things like Amazon with an MP3 store. We7 in the UK as well is an important one. But when faced with piracy on such an endemic scale, for them to go, right, let's try it. Let's use this as a big experiment. I think that speaks more of the relationship that Nokia have with the music store, with the music publishers, than anything else they could do. And I already think that that is a success. Nokia's put that on the table. They've argued successfully for it. I think that that is the biggest success before even one single file has been downloaded in China. Would you not say?
I think you're absolutely right there. I mean, I spoke to Nokia about this, and they were obviously, I think, quite pleased to get this in place. It's going to be on 8 devices, and it's going to be available in about 8,000 retail locations in China. They don't have quite the same sort of distribution model in terms of through operators as we're familiar with in Europe. So this is going to be accessible to everyone who wants to buy one of these phones. And there's a pretty wide selection, including some Chinese-specific ones like the E72i and the 5800W edition. But pretty much all the Nokia phones running Symbian or running S60 are going to be included in this offering. And as you say, I think it's pretty amazing to see this kind of agreement go through in what is the world's biggest mobile market. There are roughly 750 million mobile subscribers in China. And to put that into perspective, that's more than Europe and the US combined. Admittedly, it's different scales, but the potential of that market is unprecedented. And interestingly, Nokia also mentioned in its press release that it was going to release Comes With Music in India in due course. Now, I think that will probably have DRM protection. But when I spoke to them about this announcement, they said, you know, our vision of digital music still involves, you know, DRM-free music. And so they want to get DRM-free music everywhere. But, you know, they are very much held back by the agreements, the contracts they have to sign with the big labels. And that's mainly the four big labels. I mean, I think if they agree to it, the sort of independent labels would tend to fall into line. And probably the independent labels are more open to experimenting anyway. But what that means is if the Chinese model works, I think the labels would be more inclined to listen to Nokia for future business models as well. What we will see in the next year or so, indeed it's already started happening in some of the 30 Nokia Music countries, is having DRM-free on the paper track or the a la carte option. It will probably be a bit longer on comes with music, and there's no real way of knowing or seeing where the market will go. But I think the other thing that this underlines is how seriously Nokia is taking music as a service. And it doesn't receive much attention, you know, compared to the likes of Spotify or iTunes or even some of the sort of smaller digital music stores that Ewan mentioned, like We7 or Amazon. But Nokia has managed to launch their music services at a pretty much an unprecedented rate compared to anybody else. In 18 months, they've launched in 30 countries. Interesting, they've had most success in the emerging markets where Nokia has been strong over the last year and a half. And there have been some numbers which have suggested comes with music has basically bombed in the developed countries like Europe and Sweden, for example. But it speaks well that they are able to launch on a global way. And I think some of the success may come later on. I mean, Ewan, I don't know what your opinion is. Having a sort of worldwide music offering offers a scale to some of the labels and the music industry that in the end is going to be quite attractive, isn't it?
It is, yes. And let's be clear, there's one question that Nokia has not yet answered. It's whether user information is going to be embedded in these music files. One of the things that you can do with MP3 is when it's released from the store, downloaded onto a personal computer, you can tag a unique identifier, a username, or maybe a SIM card number, maybe in this case. So it's possible to track where a DRM-free file actually goes. Now, some stores specifically don't use this. I mean, if I remember correctly, Amazon have said, we do not put stuff in, we do not add user metadata into the MP3. Yeah. I'm not sure what Nokia's stance is yet.
I've got some good news for you there, because I did ask them about this issue. It's a so-called dirty MP3 issue, and they're not going to have any information that will be trackable in either the DRM-free offering for Comes With Music in China or indeed their paper track service. That's not something they're investigating. I think it's something that's been popularized by iTunes. And obviously, it's a way for the music industry to sort of see if people are pirating content that they've downloaded DRM-free. I think, of course, the ones that are most savvy, who are probably the big-scale pirates, will probably know enough to be able to strip that away. So it's not very surprising.
Yeah, so little tiny happy dance there. But in terms of global reach, let me address that, because I did miss that one out when bringing up that point there. It's always important to ask yourself, where's the money? Now, the music industry, even though it says it's losing £200 million just in the UK because of copyright theft and such like, let's put it aside, there still has to be money made somewhere. And Comes With Music is not going to be earning the industry a huge amount of money. Even if every phone out there hadn't had the subscription fee, it's still significantly less than paying 80p per track. Basic economics. Even if people only use 100 files or so on, it doesn't work out. But what Comes With Music does, specifically with the storefronts, both on the handset and on the desktop, is that it gives a portal of advertising. It's very interesting. If we just look at iTunes for a second, they've just had 100 billion tracks suddenly come down, and they listed their top tracks of all time. And I think like 11 of the top 20 tracks of all time were songs that were available in the last couple of months that were always pushed on the front page of iTunes. If you want to find out, have a good guess at what the number one is going to be in the UK, you have a look at Comes With Music and see which single is being pushed that week. I suspect that one of the reasons that the label like Comes With Music and are kind of tactically supporting it and pushing it is because it gives them a huge window where they can put on display their favourite artist of the week. They can give Little Boots or Pixie Dust that week the little push, or Lady Gaga can have another go the next week and promote those people. And then ancillary things like posters, tours, t-shirts and such likes, they'll be able to make back much more revenue there. A lot of new music contracts now that are seeing ancillary stuff and concerts and paraphernalia, that money goes through the labels and they can take quite a large percentage cut of that as well. So yes, the labels are giving up on money, but I think they're actually gaining something better. They're gaining fixed advertising space on mobile handsets around the world from the people who are actually talking with the music, buying and interacting with the music. And I think that's incredibly important for them as they change their business models in the 21st century.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I think the interesting thing with company music is it probably offers more of a potential revenue stream than some of the free streaming services that have become increasingly popular. But it seems to be widely acknowledged now that the music industry as a whole probably has to evolve, in the sense that the idea of, you know, pay-per-track music is, you know, starting to go away with the likes of Spotify and other streaming services coming. And it's really thanks in part to the internet age that has destroyed distribution costs in terms of things like CDs. You know, downloads cost very little indeed. And it seems to be, you know, there is a, at least on the edges of people thinking about where the music industry is going to evolve, the money will come not necessarily from music, which will effectively become free, but as you say, the ancillary events, be it live concerts, posters, or maybe getting extra album art or information videos and things like that. I mean, as a whole, do you expect, you know, in the next, well, let's put it out to the sort of decade timeline, music as a whole to become relatively free, but the music industry to sort of reimagine itself around the ancillary products, Ewan? I mean, I know you're the music guru on all that,
which isn't saying much. Yes, I don't think we're going to go backwards from where we are now. And when I say we, I mean the internet as a whole. If you want a piece of music online, you will find it. You know, okay, it might take 10 or 15 minutes for some of the obscure stiff little fingers tracks that you want to find, but you can find it. Comes with Music is a way to easily find music. I mean, and I've been using it just suddenly go, I've just heard a track on Glee. Sorry, secret's out, but it should be obvious. I wonder what the original sounded like. Bang, bang, bang. I'm sitting watching Glee. I'm doing it on the X6 handset. Put in the name. Oh, that's the artist's name. Bang, track. It's on the phone. It's on a... it's added to a playlist marked Glee Originals. So the genie is out of the bottle. It's not going to go back in. Okay, so the music industry have to accept that. If they'd accept that 8 or 9 years ago when Napster first came out and handed it to them, then I think we would be in a completely different playing field now. But we're not. We're in the point where people now expect any music track they want to come down. CD sales are still there. People are still buying music. People are still buying vinyl. There's still collectibles. But for the sort of mass market consumption, I think that we are going to end up with something that's a bit like the subscription model and a bit like Comes With Music. I think Comes With Music is going to remain unique for another couple of years, the fact that you can download anything and have it onto a handset. But I think by around 2012, you'll be able to pick up these services, you know, in the same way that you pick up a bundle of SMSs. I mean, it may be that, you know, in future months, you'll be paying £5 to have 500 free downloads on Orange, and it'll be treated like an SMS. It's just there. It's a value add. What it means is the music industry has to get used to less money coming in on a track basis. They either have to make the revenue up somewhere else, or they have to succumb to having less revenue. I suspect they're going to try to do the former, but in reality, I think we're going to be looking at the latter. I think it'll be a little shakeout of the big labels. So it used to be 7. There's only 4 now, thanks to mergings and stuff like. I think we're going to have one more merger. I don't know which ones. I think we're going to end up with 3 large labels, 4 or 5 strong medium indies, and then everybody else on the internet. We're going to lead to a much flatter curve of music, but we're going to have a lot more access as well. The problem is going to be in promotion. When you have all these bands out there, how do bands get noticed? Well, they get noticed on the screen of the mobile phone. Who's controlling that screen? Well, Nokia, Apple, the labels and the relationship that they have with them, Amazon on the side going, let us in, we've got an MP3 store as well. I don't think that'll ever make big league as well, but it will still be there as well as the major indie.
Yeah, and no doubt operators will be sticking their oar in as well. What you said is interesting there, of course. The majority of music consumption will be taken through place through mobile devices. Now, it's again talking about the mobile phone is becoming a dominant force in sort of the digital world moving forward. One of the interesting things, we've had some questions about this, and people have been saying, what about, you know, Spotify-like services? And while I do think they have a role to play, I think people underestimate the expense, or rather the costs involved in having always-on streaming music. And that's both in terms of data costs, and we can think of that in terms of data saturation on the network and all that kind of thing. But really, the big problem is in energy, and you can have locally stored MP3 players and you know, get up to even now 24 hours music, and that will go upwards. But when you're streaming over the internet, that will be cutting down towards the 4 or 5 hour mark. And of course, there's the availability of connections, which aren't universal, both in terms of availability and speed. And so the hybrid model, I think, is the most likely. And I think mobile will actually drive that hybrid model more than anything else. So,
and we have to remember Spotify is still really only Sweden and the UK. I mean, the American markets just aren't touching it yet because they don't think there's enough money.
But of course, those streaming services go beyond Spotify in terms of things like Last.fm, which do work well, I think, on the desktop. Where energy isn't a problem, but given the dominant listening device is probably going to be something mobile, I think it has more of a problem on streaming than perhaps is given credence at first glance.
The phrase you're looking for is, you kind of change the laws of physics.
Absolutely. Thank you, Scotty. So while Scotty is beaming up in the background, we'll just have a quick mention of Ovimaps 3.3, and we'll pass through this one very quickly. We've talked a lot about this in previous podcasts. And this is the news that the E71 and the E66 are getting Ovimaps 3.3. That's the one with free navigation. Now, Nokia have also said these are going to be the only S60 3.1 devices to get it. So despite what I said, some 3.1 devices have got it. But it does mean no Ovimaps with free navigation for the N95, E90 and some of the earlier devices. It looks like we may well get some extra compatibility on some 3.2 devices, that's S60 3.2 devices, such as the N85, but we haven't actually had the announcements about yet, so watch this space. But Nokia again doing a good job extending it out. I suspect there will still be people who are saying, what about my three-year-old device? And the news is there, you really do have to upgrade if you want to get it. I'm sorry for people who don't like that, but Nokia are a commercial business. They did say there were technical constraints involved, and certainly the E71 and E66 benefit from having a little bit more free RAM and actually a slightly modified hardware platform compared to most S60 3.1 devices. So I suspect that's the reason. Right there, the E-series devices are typically a little bit more mature, their hardware platforms, but in the future we're probably going to see more unified hardware platforms, so there'll be much less of this going on. Okay, so staying
I can sum up to the N95 users, nobody go, why is it not my device? I can be really, really simple on this one. Get over it, buy something new.
Well, thank you for that incredibly diplomatic approach, Ewan.
Well, we've tried the diplomatic approach for years and all about Symbian. It's like Nokia a company. They have to make money. They are supporting old devices to a certain point, and there's just a point where they just go, it's not worth it anymore. We need you to spend another 100 quid buying a 5230, for example, of which 80 quid is probably build cost. So 20 quid has to go to software and everything. Guys, if you want Nokia to keep making really good phones, you have to buy them.
There we go. So staying with Maps, it's just a quick mention that Nokia has today, as we're recording this on Friday, announced the acquisition of Metacarta. Now, Metacarta are a firm who I think are based out of Massachusetts in the US, who do geo-search, and that's searching for things on maps or geotagging, placing things on maps. So one of their products allows websites to put their news stories displayed on a map as a visualization. But they're also quite well, as I say, they're probably best known for their tools that do geo search, and that's one area that we know that Ovimaps is somewhat lacking compared to Google Maps. So no doubt it's a sort of a talent and technology acquisition for Nokia, and some of that stuff will be folded into Ovimaps, so you can expect to see improved geo search on Ovimaps in due course. And Nokia have already done this with a couple of their other acquisitions, notably Places, which sort of morphed into good things, and actually I suspect there's a lot more to come from that acquisition as well. But Nokia have proved to be quite I think sensible in buying small firms to improve their location, their social location offerings. That's after all where Maps came from, right in the beginning with Smart2Go. Navtech is of course part of that acquisition cycle, but as I say, I'm really looking at the smaller ones here. We'll have a story up on the website so you can find out a bit more about it then. Staying with small stories, we're also just going to give a quick mention to Symbian Web Tools. We've mentioned web runtime frequently on this podcast as probably the easiest way to get an application onto a Symbian phone. In terms of brands looking to do basic things, I would thoroughly recommend it. I think probably the easiest way to be cross-platform is to build a nice-looking mobile website that is styled with sort of touch devices in mind, you know, with big elements, nice and easy to read, and then do some kind of shortcut icon, and you can do that very easily in web runtime, and there are various other options for the other platforms. But if you want to do more sophisticated things in web runtime, Symbian is certainly the leading platform in that regard, and from purely web-based technologies in terms of JavaScript and CSS, you can access via the APIs some of the things like the gallery, contact information, system information, and more. And it's continuing to be developed. So what Symbian have come up with is Symbian Web Tools, which is a tool to enable developers to build these web runtime applications more quickly. It's based on Eclipse and also uses Chromium, all the open source components, to create a tool that lets you write the code, you know, auto completion, things like that, as well as having a little preview in the side so you can see what it looks like without having to load it onto the phone. You can see more information on blog.symbian.org, as well as the Symbian Developer Wiki. So if you're into web runtime, go and check it out. There are, of course, also tools available via forum nokia.com.
This is a wonderful move from the Symbian Foundation in regards to the web tools, because for so long we've been banging our heads, going back in over a couple of years. It's like you went to the Symbian website and you couldn't get developer tools. Like, they left it with the Forum Nokia, they left it with Panasonic in those days, or Sendo, and you had to download all the SDKs and go off to the other companies who are making the handsets, find the tools, and bring them back in again. And you know, for the point all the time that Symbian was meant to be this wonderfully compact OS that worked with everything, it was so granular from a manufacturer basis all those years ago that it was just really hard to get started and find those first steps to get started on Symbian. Now they've put it on their website, this web runtime tools, I think, is a brilliant idea, because it puts it in one place. It puts it in a sensible place. I want to write something for Symbian. Where will I go? The Symbian website. Where's the download? The Symbian website. Does it address all the Symbian operating system handsets? Yes, it does. One place, one question, one answer, hopefully leading to success. I'm glad to see this. I want to see a lot more of this.
Absolutely. No, it's good to see them doing this. Of course, I think the tools issue is always going to come up, but if you can provide a basic way of offering you know, tools from developers from one page, it's certainly going to be attractive. And web runtime is certainly one of the easiest ways to get an application running on a Symbian phone. So I believe you, and that there has been some other mobile news announcements this week. Do you know anything about who's been doing those?
Yeah, the Labour Party rushed the digital economy bill through in the wash-up period for the general election.
I was perhaps referring to another one, a bit more fruity-flavoured.
Oh, right. Oh, we got bananas. Doctor Who's back. Apple have done something. Apple have done something. Hey! So,
there has been, of course, the usual hype around an Apple announcement in this particular
really?
Case.
Has there? I missed it.
It was iPhone OS 4.0. Despite this being a Symbian insight, we thought we'd take a quick look at some of this, because clearly it's a good idea to keep an eye on what is going on elsewhere in the mobile industry. So I was certainly following along on the announcement yesterday. I think there's a couple of big things that we'll mention. Multitasking has come to the iPhone and to the iPad. There's also some application improvements, and there's some improvements on the UI, things like folders, so you can sort out your applications, improvements to the mail program, far too many to mention. There's so a social networking element added into games, sort of a bit Xbox Live or PlayStation Network-like. And there's also iAd, which is Apple, sort of as a result of buying a company called Quattro Wireless, essentially building an advertising system that lets you have rich emotional experience ads. And these are really going to be in the free game. So this is an offering that's aimed at developers who are, I think probably it's fair to say, mainly games, who are offering their application free through the App Store but want to monetize it in some way. And Steve Jobs got up on stage and said, you know, what we're looking at is popping up an ad maybe 10 times a day. And was talking very convincingly, I think, about how these ads are much deeper experience in terms of doing rich video. You don't have to go out of the application to use them. They may include mini games. Certainly quite attractive, and I think perhaps the most far-reaching of the announcements that was made. I would say that it's being sort of panned as a a Google versus Apple move. I think the only thing I'd say here is the Apple-style advertising is very different to Google's, which is very much a sort of a cost-led exercise using computer algorithms to make the most efficient way of using advertising on a long-tail basis, where Apple is very much akin, I would say, to the sort of glossy ads in magazines, which sort of promote brand, promote experience, and try to connect on an emotional level. How well each of that will work, I mean, Steve Jobs was quite open when he said that Apple is a babe in the woods as far as advertising is concerned, but it's certainly very interesting, and I think other companies with mobile aspirations probably need to look at building in advertising into their platforms in one way or another, or providing the developer tools, and that's probably the key there, because advertising funded applications and services are only going to become more important, and advertisers do like the idea of having targeted groups that they can get at very easily, so certainly one to watch. I think it's just worth mentioning multitasking briefly. Now, it's easy to say that Symbian has this since 2002 with the 7650. I think that's a slightly simplistic way to look at it. The multitasking as it's been implemented on the iPhone isn't really true multitasking in the way that you might have it on Symbian or MeeGo. It's what they've done is introduce 7 background APIs in terms of things like playing music, being able to do VoIP in the background, task completion, so that's if you're uploading a photo to Flickr, it can continue in the background. It does, for my mind, still beg the question why they haven't implemented a full system, and it seems to me that the OS just isn't capable of it. And Steve Jobs was at pains to say, you know, we've done the best job we can, this is the best multitasking on mobile, and it's quite hard to take that claim seriously when there are multiple other platforms who are doing it without significant impact on either battery life or resource consumption. It will no doubt be a debate that goes on and on. We look forward to actually seeing it running on the device, but it doesn't seem to be quite there yet. I mean, Euron, I know you've taken a very quick look at this in terms of multitasking. I mean, do you feel that having a multitasking that's sort of defined within certain APIs perhaps limits the things you might do with it, and therefore is a kind of stifle on innovation?
I'm still laughing at rich emotional experience. It's an advert. Right, let's talk about this multitasking thing. You know what? What do you do in the background? What needs to run in the background? This is what Apple have done. They have actually distilled the question of what is a background app, and they've come up with their own answer. It's not necessarily the answer that someone used to a PC or a desktop environment or indeed another mobile phone operating environment would come up with, but they know their customer. And, you know, let's be honest, Apple are probably the people who know exactly what the customer want. Not what the customers are asking for, but what the customers want and need. And they've come up, you know, with things like music, so streaming applications, things like background IM, things like background uploading. To call it multitasking, it's true. And if we were going on strict definitions, the iPhone already had multitasking because the clock kept running at the same time as you were reading something on the screen. Okay, now, it's not true multitasking in a computer term. In a true computer term, it's everything is running at the same time. It's not. It's keeping certain things running at the same time. And it's still defined at the Apple App Store level. You know, your app will be decided there how much of a background access it can have to. And background access is probably a much better way to describe this than multitasking. It allows programs in the background to access stuff that appears in the foreground of one of your senses, be that a sense that's uploading to the internet or the speakers, so it's uploading to your ears, as it were. Will it make the iPhone a better experience? Yes. Is it pushing the hardware that Apple have created to the very edge? Yes, because it's only available in the 3GS. It's only available in the faster processors. So, you know, there's an underlying assumption that the older phones just weren't able to run even this limited choice of 7 things extra in the background. It takes the ecosystem right out and sits on the edge. Yeah, we had background and multitasking in the 7650, but we still only had one screen. We only had 4 megabytes of storage. I think the RAM available on those devices was, you know, it was measured in... I think it hit a couple of meg, but I'm not sure. I would actually honestly have to go back and look at the specification sheets. But what it does do is it gives people the experience that they want and they need. They can keep IM connected in the background. They can not have to wait 90 seconds for a Flickr picture to upload for them to take another one. It gives the people the experience that they need. And giving experiences is what's going to be needed in all of these devices, in Android, in Apple, in Nokia, in Samsung. All of them are about delivering you experiences. You want to be able to do stuff on these phones. You want to be able to jump between your music tracks very quickly while browsing. All of these phones must be able to do that. And now Apple has joined them. They've done it in a very Apple-like way. They've done it in a way that restricts the access to the system. They've done it in a way that they still 100% control every single bit of code that runs on their own platform. That is their right. People have chosen to do that. Personally, I think it should be a completely open system, but I've no fundamental disagreement with the way in which they've implemented this. I think it's smart, given the hardware. I think it's sensible, given the user needs, and I think it's going to provide them with a much better base for people to create third-party applications.
Yeah, I think you have some excellent points there, Ewan. My only hesitation would be that it's very typical of Apple in that they've done what I would regard as the sort of minimum necessary to create a good experience for users. And after all, as you say, that is what Apple is all about. However, part of me sort of misses the fact that they haven't done the complete job, if you like, and one wonders why. Particularly, I'm thinking here of future trends in terms of looking at the way state changes happen on a mobile device. And I'm thinking here things like changing in location or changes in your calendar, things that happen in the background, you know, the idea of your device being aware of what's going on around it, or contextual awareness, the intelligence of devices. And that's going to be very hard to implement any kind of applications that do that kind of thing, which I think is kind of the next stage in the evolution of mobile devices, or mobile applications and services, I should say. Because they require sort of true local multitasking in the background. By defining it within a very fixed area, you say these are the kinds of multitasking things that are permitted, without perhaps allowing the innovation on the edge. And that's why I asked you the question earlier, is perhaps it might stifle innovation, as I think we've probably seen on some of the existing bits of iPhone versus other platforms. Many of the most innovative applications start elsewhere, and then we'll either move to the iPhone in a different way. And clearly the classic example of this thus far has been something like Skype, which actually, now that it has become mainstream, Apple are allowing it by doing background VoIP, and it's going to have the same experience, well, fairly same experience on iPhone as you do on Symbian. It's still, of course, the proof is in the pudding here. But I think one of the really interesting things you pointed out there as well is it's only running on the most recent hardware. So that's the iPhone 3GS and I think the iPod Touch third generation. The earlier devices, the iPhone 3G, the iPhone and the iPod Touch first and second generation, aren't getting multitasking. They are getting many of the other iPhone OS 4 enhancements, which is obviously good news. But it does suggest that there is fragmentation being introduced to the iPhone ecosystem. Now, Apple have now been around long enough that fragmentation becomes an issue, and every platform faces this. You know, it's just as applicable to Android, to Windows Mobile, to Symbian. How you deal with it is more open to debate. And I think also added into this is the fact that iPhone OS 4 is coming to the iPad several months, they're saying summer versus autumn, later than it is on the other devices. And it does beg the question, if these platforms are so similar, why is there such a big lag time for getting OS 4 onto the iPad? So I think this fragmentation issue, it'll be very interesting to see how this practically impacts upon developers, simply because when you're developing an application, are you going to have to think about, does this device have OS 4 or not? And does that mean I have to code it in a certain way, or even have two versions? And Apple say you're going to be able to detect the device, but we know from existing platforms that methodology, you know, relying on developers, doesn't always work very well. You know, Apple have been able to avoid this problem thus far by having very, very impressive software upgrade rates, essentially because you have to connect your Apple device to iTunes to do some of the more interesting things with it. You know, the iTunes.
What, like charging?
Well, charging you can do separately, but a lot of things require plugging into a PC. And as a result, they've been able to drive very high levels of upgrading from one version of the OS to another. Now that is going to be a problem because some of them just won't be able to. I'll be interested to hear your take on this, Ewan. Do you think fragmentation is something that the iPhone is now going to face? And is that going to be a serious issue in that you won't get the same experience across everything?
No. And I'll tell you why. Fashion. Nobody in their right mind would be seen with a Dolce & Gabbana handbag of 2006 in the 2007 season. anybody who follows Apple to in the sense of a consumer sense will want to be seen with last year's phone. You know why? Because there'll be this nagging suspicion that everybody else will suddenly realize and they will be made a pariah. And that is why Apple have such a huge upgrade on their new operating system, on the new flash versions, and on the new phones and hardware. Nobody's going to admit it, but you know, people buy Apple because it's fashionable. It's like, you know, if I said to you, name me a good year of Dom Perignon champagne. Right, most people say Dom Perignon 57. You know why? Because that's what James Bond always orders. People will go for something that's fashionable, that will make them look cool, and that has to be the latest Apple thing. People will forgive Apple this because they will have this arrogance of going, oh, you're not on the new one, you're not cool, you're not getting the cool toys. That would never happen. I mean, what happens in Nokia is people go, why can't we have free maps on our N95 from a phone that was designed in 2006? Why? You wouldn't get that with Apple. People would go, that was System 7. Sorry, we're on OS XXX316 Jaguar Hyena now. You're not cool anymore. And they'll go back into the corner and they will go and find a Jaguar and a Hyena and put it together so they can be cool again. Apple have created this cult that pulls them forward. So, for that reason, I don't think they'll have fragmentation issues because everybody will want to be on the latest one, because otherwise they'll just be made to look like, oh, I don't know, insert web celebrity you don't like here.
So what do you think happens to all those people using older devices, all the older devices? Do they no longer matter because they're not cool?
They die.
They die. Well, that's
taken away and crushed and made into new circuit boards for new Apple devices.
I rather think the devices might hang around a little longer. So I think the fragmentation issue might be more of a problem.
I think the case is the truth will be somewhere in between. But you know, the reason they have very high upgrades is because they have this loyalty, they have this support, and they have this fashionability, which means that anybody who actually cares will do the upgrades.
Well, I was going to say, I think that is a good point, in that the people that care most about this will be upgrading, but developers aren't really concerned whether it's a cool person using their application or not. They want to know about the addressable market because that's the way they make money.
And there's an API for that.
There's an API just to detect how cool the person using your app is. Yes, well, I wouldn't be surprised. Apple certainly do need to strengthen their middleware, and indeed they have done in this release. It's more mature than it was. They've still got a while to go with some of the APIs. But joking aside, I do actually think that this will be an issue because as more things get introduced, you start to fragment. And it's quite interesting because you get to the point where you go, well, how much is this going to happen? So, and looking at it, you see roughly a 2-year cycle. And looking at the iPhone numbers, you can see that that's maybe going to be 100 million or so in each fragmented segment. Now, that's still quite a lot of devices, but that does pale in comparison to some of what you'll be getting from the other platforms, you know, Android and Symbian.
I'm going to be
hundreds of millions. Now,
I'm going to be cynical here. I've got to ask you one question. Yep. How long until the battery doesn't work anymore on an iPhone? Would it happen to be about 2 years?
Would that perhaps be a slightly cynical point of view?
See, look, you're a politician. You avoided the question by answering me the same question by asking it. Nice.
So there you go. Some discussion of Apple iPhone OS 4.0. Certainly it's going to be compared to future versions of Android and indeed Symbian 3 and Symbian 4, which is, I guess, what it will be the direct competitors against towards the end of this year and indeed the early part of next year. Plenty of discussion. Would be interested to hear your views on this as well. But ultimately, I think we're going to have to wait until we see this running on phones, just as with Symbian 3. We're going to have to wait until it gets out onto the market and actually see how users respond to it, what the reactions are, what some of the feedback is. But that's all the time we've got for on this week's podcast. You can find us on Twitter at AAS, at Rafe Blanford, and at Ewan. You can also visit us on the web at www.allaboutsymbian.com, or if you're looking on your mobile device, I'd recommend you use our mobile site. That's mobile.allaboutsymbian.com. If you've got any feedback or questions from this podcast, please do get in touch either via the contact form on the website or email me at rafe@allaboutsymbian.com. And with all that done, it only remains me to thank my co-host, Ewan Spence, for coming along this week.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening to this podcast. Check back next week where we'll be covering the next week news, and no doubt we'll have more discussion, commentary and views on the goings-on in the mobile world. Goodbye for now.
And if they pay the ransom, we might have Steve back as well. Ta-ra.